In our study tonight, we're continuing our study of the Herod family. Now, I've mentioned to you a number of times that when we see the word Herod in the New Testament, it would be to our satisfaction, I suppose, to be able to say, well, this was this Herod and this was this Herod. And we know that because the text simply tells us that. But often it only says Herod. And we know that there was a family of Herods, and none of them were all that reputable. And when we begin to study them, we see just how horrible many of them were as far as their murdering of their sons and wives and that kind of thing, marrying, intermarriage with all kinds of... Anyhow, a lot to be said about that. But we mentioned earlier that the purpose of our study of that is primarily for our satisfaction, because the text doesn't identify in the text which Herod it is. And we I think, can do that with some additional study, but it's not necessary unto our salvation. So I don't necessarily tonight want to take an extended period of time to talk about all of the Herods that we've discussed already, but I know that we've talked about Herod Antipas up here at the top. We've talked about Herod the Great, Herod Philip over here that was married to Herodias, Herod Philip over here that married the daughter of Herodias, Herod Antipas over here that went to visit Herod Philip over here and stole his wife and married her, and Herod Antipas also, of course, is the one that killed John the Baptist and heard the trial of Jesus. We talked about Herod Agrippa the first down here. Now you see other Herods on the screen, but I'm not going to take the time tonight to talk about all of them and details pertaining to their life because they're not significant to our study. But I do want to talk just a little bit more to bring us up to speed about Herod Agrippa the first, and then I want to talk with you about Herod Agrippa the second. In our study last time, we talked about Herod Agrippa the first, and we noted that in Acts chapter 12, in fact, I think as we concluded our class, we talked about this man, and we noted in Acts chapter 12 that Herod Agrippa the first is the one that proclaimed himself, as it were, to be some kind of a god. And the text tells us that he was eaten of worms. Now, I'm looking at my text to try to find that, and I'm on the wrong page. So, Acts chapter 12, look, if you will, please, beginning at verse 1. Acts chapter 12, verse 1. It says, "Now about that time Herod the king put forth his hands to afflict certain of the church. And he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. And those were the days of unleavened bread." Now let's pause there. As we talked about this particular Herod, we noted that this is the first time that the Jews employ the Roman government to persecute the church. And when Herod has opportunity to persecute James or kill James, he does it simply because it pleased the Jews. They were wanting to persecute the church, and now we've got James dead and Peter in line to die. We've talked about Peter's miraculous escape or release from prison. Josephus, I believe it is, I did have the material up, and I think I closed it. Yes, I did. I closed it, but we don't need it. Had the material up that Josephus wrote concerning Herod Agrippa I. He evidently had on some kind of attire that when the sun shined on the clothes that he had, it kind of radiated or glowed. So the people declared him as God, and he accepted their worship as God. He didn't tell them any different. And so they proclaimed him as God, and he saw himself then as God. Now, Josephus tells us about how that an angel of the Lord smote him, and the text tells us, and how that he was eaten of worms from the inside out. And what a horrible death that must have been for Herod Agrippa I. Now, unless somebody has anything further about this man, I'm basically through talking about Herod Agrippa I. Does anybody have any additional information? that you want to talk about?
I read one commentator that said, we don't need to think that Herod Agrippa the First was smitten with and died from worms right in front of the audience.
No.
He died later on in his life.
It took several. From what I understand, it took days for this to kill him. I think it was on the timeline, it would follow closely on the heels of this, or his death would have no significance to him proclaiming himself as a god. Yes, Carol?
The way mine reads is that immediately he was struck. So immediately it began. Of course, worms is a slow
process. Slow agonizing process. But yes.
Not
quick. Now, Herod Agrippa II, as you see on the chart, I want us to, especially those of you who are or were in our Acts study, you do well remember, I'm sure, the series of events from chapter to chapter, beginning in chapter 21. In chapter 21 of the book of Acts, what are we beginning to read about? Acts chapter 21. Paul's arrest, in the city of Jerusalem. He was told by Agabus the prophet that when he arrived in Jerusalem, he would be bound, and he said that he was willing not only to be bound, but also to die in Jerusalem if need be. But in Acts chapter 21, he was indeed arrested in Jerusalem, and the mob was about to tear him apart. And a certain man rescued him from the mob by arresting him. What was the man's name? Claudius Lysias. Claudius Lysias. He was a centurion, if I recall, or is he referred to as a captain? I just had a memory lapse.
Chief captain.
Okay, then he was over 100 centurions, which tells us how broad his rank was. He was over 100 centurions. Now, a centurion reigns over how many soldiers, or rules over?
100.
So that tells us the place where Claudius Lysias was. He had a large number of men under him, yes.
Where is his
name? Claudius Lysias. You don't see it in Acts 21, I don't believe.
In the letter.
It's in the letter?
The letter to the person who is close to the seat.
That would be Felix.
23:27.
26, yes. Claudius Lysias, under the most excellent governor, Felix. Okay? That tells us his name. Now, he becomes a very prominent character because not only do we see him arresting Paul in chapter 21, but Paul then, on the way to be imprisoned, is going up the stairs and he makes an address to the angry Jews that are gathered together in chapter 22. And Claudius Lysias then continues to take him and places him in bonds. And then as we read in Acts chapter 23, Paul is making his defense before the Jewish court. Now, if you were a chief captain and you've got a prisoner that has created some turmoil among the Jews, wouldn't you think it the place to take him is before the Jewish court? What would you expect to find before the Jewish court? Well, yeah, you'd like to find folks that are fair-minded, nice guys, and good judges, and all that sort of thing. But when Paul appeared before the Jewish court and saw that the Jewish court was made up in part of Pharisees and in part of Sadducees, he identified himself as a Pharisee. And then what happened to the Jewish court and their judgment of Paul? All right, that's put on the shelf, and now they're fighting each other. And Claudius Lysias, once again, rescues Paul from the court. And as we continue reading, in chapter 24, as Richard has pointed out, he's sent with letters to whom? Felix, and where is Felix? In Caesarea. Now, why does he send him to Felix in Caesarea? Alright, they've sworn they'll neither eat nor drink, and the fellow's dead. Well, I imagine they're pretty hungry by now. But be that as it may, Claudius Lysias gets him out of town, takes him to Caesarea. And in fact, when Paul appears before Felix, and then Felix leaves his governorship and leaves Paul in prison, Festus, the next governor, has opportunity to hear Paul's case, and that's in Acts chapter 24. And when we read of Paul's, no, 25, in Acts 25, and when Festus hears Paul's case, there's really not much of a decision made on behalf of Festus. And Paul said, I am before the judgment seat of Rome. He had the right to receive some kind of hearing. And because he did not, he said, I appeal unto Caesar. Now, Paul, as a Roman citizen, had the privilege to make such an appeal, and it was Claudius Lysias that puts him on a ship and takes off, and here we go toward Rome, where he eventually makes his defense here before he goes to Agrippa II. Let's back up, if we will, and notice some passages in chapter 25 and then in chapter 26. You're familiar with this material. In Acts chapter 25, as we read about Herod Agrippa II, I want to pass beyond that. I want to look at chapter 24, beginning in verse 27. Verse 27. In verse 27, it says, For it seemeth to me... That's 25. Chapter 24. I'll be there in a minute. Chapter 24, verse 27. Here we go. It says, But when 2 years were fulfilled, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to gain favor with the Jews, Felix left Paul in bonds. Now that tells us of the change of governorship. But beginning in verse... my Bible just changed pages. In chapter 25, verse 1... It says, Festus, therefore, having come into the province after 3 days, went up to Jerusalem to Caesarea. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they besought him, asking a favor against him that he would send him to Jerusalem, laying plot to kill him on the way. Howbeit, Festus answered that Paul was kept in charge at Caesarea, and that he himself was about to depart thither shortly. Let them therefore, saith he, that are of power among you, go down with me, and if there is anything amiss in the man, let them accuse him. Now this is a part of Festus' responsibility as governorship. He's playing by the rules. If you've done something wrong, here are your accusers, let them come. You have the right as a Roman citizen to face your accusers. And so again, he's playing by the rules. But beginning in verse 6, it says, And when he had tarried among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down into Caesarea, and on the morrow he sat in the judgment seat, and commanded Paul to be brought. And when he was come, the Jews that had come from Jerusalem stood round about him, bringing against him many and grievous charges, which they could not prove. While Paul said in his defense, Neither against the law, of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I sinned at all. But Festus, desiring to gain favor with the Jews, answered Paul and said, Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me? Now what's going to happen to Paul if he returns to Jerusalem? All right, he's going to be killed. This is the plot. And so we learn then that Paul appeals his case to Caesar, and the next step then is the traveling eventually to Caesar. But if you'll pick up the reading beginning in chapter 26, verse 1. Chapter 26, verse 1. It says, And Agrippa said unto Paul, Thou art permitted to speak for thyself. Then Paul stretched forth his hand and made his defense. Now question, what brought Paul from Festus, now having appealed his case to Caesar, what brought Paul from Festus to Agrippa?
Agrippa came to Paul.
All right, well, what brought them together is my point.
Because Paul was
Paul, well, that's true. Paul was a part of the area that Agrippa reigned over. Keep in mind now, what was the rank of of Festus. He was governor. What was the rank of Agrippa? He was a king. Okay? So as king, he had rank over the area from which Paul came. And so now Paul stands before King Agrippa. Is he pleased to have that opportunity? Why? Pardon me? Well, yeah, he's passing the buck. That's right. But one of the things that we've noted about the Herods, Donna?
The passing, he's appealed unto Caesar.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, the lineage.
All right, Festus could have sent him, but Festus didn't know what to put on the paperwork. So the king comes down, and Festus wants the king to interrogate Paul so he can help him know what to put on the paperwork so that when he sends him to Caesar, he'll have something to accuse Paul of. Now, that sounds fishy, doesn't it? But that's what it was. James?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say was Agrippa was coming down, so Festus has a good opportunity here to say, hey, I've got this real special case here that I really don't know quite how to handle, so what do you think?
Yeah. That's it exactly.
But, you know, also, in Paul's mind, this is an opportunity for him to bring the gospel before a king.
Well, that's true, and of course, that is what he had been doing. Told, or what at least Ananias had been told, that he would appear before King.
Yeah. People who are accountable, even at the highest level, were going to hear what they needed to hear.
That's true. Yes. Good point.
Yeah. Well, according to the Acts 25, starting at verse 14, this essentially was just a happenstance occurrence that Agrippa happened to be there because Festus laid out the case before him. But Agrippa was familiar with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to hear him.
Mm-hmm.
And given that Agrippa outranked Festus, he could have whatever he wanted. Of course, Festus wanted to make points with Agrippa anyway, so he says, tomorrow you'll hear him. So this was, but, you know, Paul, of course, said that he gladly appeared before him because, like as James says, he could lay his case out before yet another person.
All right, that's true. And what did he anticipate from Herod Agrippa II? And what do we know about the background of the Herods and their relationship with the Jews? We know that they were not Jews. What was their background? Idumean, yes. However, at this point in time, the Idumeans had been subjugated, in essence, by the Jews and had been compelled to receive circumcision and to keep the law. Now, their willingness to do that, we see in this particular case, and as the Herods began to evolve, they got further and further and further and further away from anything that resembled the law of the Jews. But does that mean they didn't know what the law of the Jews was?
They were just Samaritans living on the east side.
That's right.
Not really any difference.
Yeah. I never heard it put that way, but that's right. That's a good way to put it. They were just a mixed breed of people, and so that's exactly right. But when you begin in chapter 26 and look at verse two, Paul said, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, that I am to make my defense before thee this day, touching all the things whereof I am accused by the Jews, especially because thou art expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews, wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently." He recognizes Herod Agrippa II, someone who knows what the customs and practices and beliefs of the Jews really were. Now, why is that so significant in Paul's case? Look at the text just a little bit further. In verse 4, we'll abbreviate some things here. He talks about his manner of life and so forth, that the Jews know this and they'd be willing to testify. He lives as a Pharisee. And if you look at verse 6 specifically, he said, "And now I stand here to be judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. And concerning this hope, I am accused by the Jews, O king." Now, that statement is incredibly impressive. What was it that the Jews looked for, Carol?
Oh, that was what I was going to talk
about. Okay, go ahead.
Was this a case where they could carry on their religion and that was fine, but if somebody was bringing a new religion, that was not permitted, and he's making the point that this is the Jewish religion, this is the next, that this is part of it, this is not some new religion that's not allowed?
This to answer your question, yes. This was an extension of that which came from background from the Jews. Now, let us not come to the conclusion that the church and its existence and so forth found its background in the Jews in terms of the Jews' beginning. They were the first ones to get to be a part of it.
Just the fact that he's saying this isn't some new religion that should be considered illegal.
That's correct. Yes, I believe that's correct. Jamie?
The advantage of having Agrippa here is that he can come to understand that what Paul is saying is that I haven't done anything illegal even by Mosaic law. I'm just preaching the fulfillment of it, just like Moses said.
Well, that's right. The Jews know that. Now, the next step, Sue?
The Jews were always looking for the earthly king.
Exactly what I was looking for. Yes. The Jews were looking for the coming of the Messiah, but they thought that he would be a king over an earthly empire. They thought that this was the hope of Israel, to have an earthly king. The Messiah is coming, and he's going to rule over us. But look, if you will, again at verse 6. What was the promise made of God unto our fathers? Did it have to do with the coming of an earthly kingdom? No. You remember back in Genesis chapter 12, God had said to Abraham, and then later to Isaac in Genesis 26, to Jacob in Genesis 28, that in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now we know that was the promise that was made to the fathers because it's referenced in the New Testament at least twice. It's referenced in Galatians chapter 3 and it's referenced also in Acts chapter 3. And we see what it entailed. It entailed forgiveness, redemption, and those spiritual blessings. So when Paul says to Agrippa, I'm glad to stand here to be judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, under which promise our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. They hope to be a part of this earthly kingdom. And he said, I'm here to be judged by you regarding the hope of Israel. Now, what had Paul formerly believed the hope of Israel was? Some kind of earthly kingdom. And that Jesus was not the Messiah, and so he held out for the coming of the Messiah who would rule over them in an earthly kingdom. But Paul said, I'm now here for the hope of Israel. What is it that Paul has learned? The hope of Israel is not physical. The hope of Israel is not physical. Now when he says in verse 8, why is it just incredible with you if God doth raise the dead? Why is that an issue with you, Mr. King? You see, I've been where all these Jews are. I know just exactly what they believe. I know just exactly what their motives were or are. I know why they have arrested me, because I did exactly the same thing. But I've learned something. Now, this is Herod Agrippa the second that we're talking about. Now, we want to go just a little further with this, and we've already looked at the passages here and noted that Paul describes Herod Agrippa as expert in all the customs and questions which are among the Jews. So he knew what the hope of Israel was. He knew what they looked forward to. Yes, Dave?
Just backtracking a little bit, back to Felix. Felix had the power to release
him, didn't he? Sure he did. Sure he did, but why didn't he?
Well, the Jews in favor.
That's right. That's right, and that's what Festus is doing.
Yeah, it's just
a 25.
Well, he could have done.
Sure he could. Yeah, I forget the verse in particular. Let's see. Verse 27 of chapter 24. But when 2 years were fulfilled, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to gain favor with the Jews, Felix left Paul in bonds. He could have released him, but he didn't want to. Politics. James, and then Juan.
Well, I was going to ask, since he's leaving political office, what benefit would it be to him to gain favor with the Jews?
Leave with honor. You see, he's got the favor of the people probably among whom he would possibly live. I don't know where Felix lived out the rest of his life, but it's possible that he wanted to live with honor of the Jews. That's speculation on my part. I've got to grant that, but that's my opinion. What?
We're getting a little ahead, but in Acts 26, verse 32, it says that Paul could have been set free if he had not been asked to talk to Caesar.
That's right.
So I think that's kind of a really political thing to say that.
Big time.
Yeah, I would have let him go, but, you know, he sat there and said he wants to go to Caesar, so. But I think that's where he was like 100%, like, look, we'll do this because, you know, whatever you say, and then we'll go from there. You know?
That's right. So Agrippa is of the opinion there's really not any paperwork necessary to send to Rome. But he's made his appeal, so now we've got to stand. That's right. So Festus could have released him. Herod could have released him. But now that the appeal has been made, to Caesar you shall go. Yes, sir.
I've always thought that verse 8 just appeared to be some sort of parenthetical expression that just jumped out of nowhere. But really, now that I read it again for the 400th time, it appears to me that really, when Paul says in the verse right above there at the end of it, and I'm reading in King James now because I'm looking at the commentary, it says, "For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews." It's really the hope of the resurrection and the fact that Jesus was resurrected from the dead.
Yeah.
That's one thing that they just find it incredible to believe.
Yeah.
That he thinks that this Jesus guy was resurrected from the dead. But in fact, if we go back into the later books of Paul, we realize that if you don't believe that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead, then your hope is in vain.
That's right.
And so, really, it makes sense that this is right here, right now, because he's saying, this is really the hope that I'm talking about, that not only was Jesus resurrected, but ultimately we'll all be resurrected.
Well, that's right. And again, that emphasizes the spiritual nature of his kingdom. This is what the hope is. It has to do with such things as forgiveness, redemption, so on. It doesn't have anything to do with the material kingdom. And granted, as you mentioned, if he was not raised from the dead, none of that stuff would ever come to pass. He would not be identified as who he claimed to be. Randy, very good point. Yes.
First of all, I find it interesting that they, at least the New American Standard, doesn't refer to him as Herod Agrippa. It's just King Agrippa.
Yeah.
So we know from history that it's Herod. The chart that I'm looking at shows Bernice is his sister. Herod.
Yes.
Herod Agrippa is the second sister.
Yes.
He's with his sister Bernice. I also show that Felix was his brother. Felix, governor of Judea.
That very well could be. Yes.
Brother of Herod Agrippa.
That could be. And if you follow that all the way back, you'll follow it back to Aristobulus, who was one of the sons that Herod the Great had killed.
Yeah. Herod Agrippa the First was their dad.
Yeah.
And Aristobulus was their grandfather.
Yeah. So you've got a lineage here that's gnarly. That means it's not so good. Okay. Now, as we pursue Paul's defense before Herod Agrippa II, you'll find that the 26th chapter is really not all that different from the 22nd chapter when Paul made his defense among the people. He reiterates many of the same things, and of course, when you're thinking of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus, there are three chapters in Acts that ought to just come to mind readily.
I'm sorry, I think I read this wrong. Felix wasn't his brother, he was his brother-in-law, because he was married to Drusilla. And Drusilla was the sister of Herod II.
Okay. I said this family tree is gnarly. You've got folks that are marrying nieces and uncles, and in the instance of Herod Agrippa with Bernice, there is some strong suspicion that she was more than a sister, that they were living together as man and wife, an incestuous relationship, and you've got a similar circumstance, if memory serves me correctly, with Felix and the woman he's living with.
Which is pointed out that she was a Jewess. That was back in Acts 24. 24:24.
Okay.
And Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess.
Yeah.
And sent for Paul and her to speak to the faith of Christ. He also mentioned that up in verse 22 that Felix had a more exact knowledge about the way.
Yeah.
So if he's married to a Jew, then he at least is more familiar with the law and customs.
Well, I can't help but grin just a little bit, because let's not give any credibility to Drusilla because she's a Jew. When you go back and read about her life, that's another gnarly character. So you might like to Google her name and see what you can find out about Drusilla. Not a very nice person. But be that as it may, Paul's defense, when you read of his conversion in the book of Acts, three chapters, what are they?
9, 22, 26.
All right, 9, 22, and 26. Very good. I want you to learn that. Don't ever forget that. 9, 22, and 26. Now, the reason is, you learn different aspects of Paul's conversion from the different accounts. I had someone ask me last week, if we have an account in the book of Acts of Paul being baptized. And we're all familiar with Acts 22:16, where the text tells us from Ananias, "Why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away thy sins." That's a pretty familiar text to us. But do we read an account in Acts where Paul was actually baptized? Yes. And where is it?
19.
Acts 9:18. He arose and was baptized. Now, that's helpful to us when we're studying with folks who are not Christians to cite examples of conversion in the book of Acts. And you want to see all that Paul did to be a Christian. You want to see that he became a believer. You want to see that he turned, he repented of his sin, and you want to see that he was baptized into Christ to wash away his sins, which tells us that he was not converted on the road to Damascus. He was not saved there. He was saved when he arose and was baptized, because it was then that he washed his sins away. Now that was 3 days after the occurrence where Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Now, I want to throw this out quickly because I don't want to spend an excessive amount of time on that either. But when we talk about the conversion of Saul of Tarsus, and we know that he was not converted on the road to Damascus or saved on the road to Damascus. If he was, then very simply put, he becomes the most miserable saved person we ever read about. When you read of conversions in the book of Acts, what generally follows someone being baptized or being remitted of their sins?
Went on their way
rejoicing. Well, Saul comes into the city of Damascus, and what's he doing for 3 days?
Fasting.
Didn't either eat nor drink. I mean, he's miserable.
Blind,
yes. And when Ananias came to him, he healed his blindness, gave him his sight back, and said, "Why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized, and wash away thy sins." What does that tell us that was still upon Paul or Saul? Sin. He's not forgiven yet. So his baptism was to wash away his sins, which had not been done on the road to Damascus. Now, to get back to the point I'm trying to get to here is his defense before King Agrippa. King Agrippa II knows the customs and questions of the Jews. We know that Paul is presenting to him what the hope of Israel is, and why the Jews have arrested him, and why he is there before King Agrippa. And he rehearses all of these events that pertain to his conversion, that is, the Lord appearing to him on the road to Damascus, and going into Damascus, the city, and so forth. But if you'll pick up the reading, beginning in verse 16 of Acts 26... Acts 26, verse 16. Now, relating the occurrence of the events, or the order of the events, the Lord has appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Now, here's Paul just relating what happened. And in verse 15, he said, "Who art thou, Lord?" And the Lord said, "I am Jesus, whom thou persecutest." Well, we see that in the other accounts. But in verse 16, the Lord said, "But arise and stand upon thy feet, for to this end have I appeared unto thee, to appoint thee a minister and a witness both of the things wherein thou hast seen me and of the things wherein I will appear unto thee. delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles unto whom I send thee, to open their eyes, that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive remission of sins and an inheritance among them that are sanctified by faith in me. Now you look carefully at the purpose. Why did Jesus appear unto Saul on the road to Damascus? One to save him. What was it that Saul was going to be doing? James?
Qualified him to be an apostle.
Elaborate on that.
Well, he was going to have to be a witness of the resurrection of Christ to do that. So that gave him that qualification.
All right, that gave him that qualification. The Lord said, I have appeared unto thee, verse 16, for this reason, to appoint thee a minister and a witness, both of the things wherein thou hast seen me and of the things wherein I will appear unto thee. That makes an interesting study as well. Other occurrences where the Lord appeared unto Saul or unto the Apostle Paul. But in this particular instance, Saul gets the opportunity to be a witness of the resurrected Christ. It's impossible for you to testify to the validity of something if you didn't see it or hear it. In other words, as James said, the work of an apostle was to be a witness of the resurrected Christ. And Paul had not yet seen the resurrected Christ. He had to see that before he could preach that it's so. That's right. We have the testimony of these folks.
Well, you know, Nick, you hear, especially denominational people, use the expression, well, this weekend we're going to go witness to people. An apostle can give witness, but you and I can't.
That's correct.
We weren't there. We haven't seen the resurrected Lord.
That's right.
All we can do is present them with the facts and evidence of eyewitnesses.
That's right.
We're not eyewitnesses ourselves.
That's right. Impossible to be unless you saw it. Okay, exactly right. Now, as Paul continues to make his defense, I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
Okay, that brings up a question about Judas. Was Judas handed himself and he didn't go through the thing on Pentecost, or he didn't go through what Paul did. So, was he really an apostle?
He was chosen by the Lord to be an apostle during his lifetime. But, of course, it becomes a moot point when you think about, well, did he testify the resurrection? No, because he killed himself. And that becomes the objective. But, yes, he was an apostle. He was chosen to be an apostle. But he ended his apostleship by betraying the Lord and then suicide.
Yeah, you know, Mickey, when Christ chose his apostles, evidently he did have a plan in mind for them to be his witnesses.
Absolutely.
The case of Judas shows us that at the end of the day, we're still free moral agents by God's design. Christ intended for Judas to go on being an apostle and carry out the message as a witness, but Judas used his own free will and decided that's not going to happen.
Well, that's right. Of course, if we turn back to the Old Testament prophecy of Zechariah, we learn that the prophet had said that he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver.
Well, and I think also that sometimes people may ask, well, how could they be called apostles until they had seen the resurrected Christ? Well, that's all part of that plan, is he chose them to be my witnesses of many things. Certainly of the resurrected Christ, but they were witnesses of more than just him being raised from the dead. They saw a lot.
That's true, but let's back up and identify, what does the word apostle mean? One sent. Are there some in the New Testament that are called, and this is not a trick question, that are called apostles that were not apostles selected by the Lord?
Barnabas.
Barnabas, yes. Yes. He was sent forth. He's called an apostle, but he was sent forth by the church in Antioch. So strictly by definition, we see that the word apostle simply means one sent forth. But when Jesus selected the apostles, they're not sent forth just yet in all the full meaning of their work. We know that they were instructed to go preach among the Jews, but not to the Gentiles. But when Jesus sent them forth, after he was raised from the dead, what were they to go preach? Jim?
The resurrected Lord. But I was going to point out, I did a quick
and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of those are in the Gospels. So in Matthew 10:2, it says, and he called unto him his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of disease and all manner of sickness. Now the names of the 12 apostles are these. And so...
I read that in the
look up the Greek there.
Listing of the names of the apostles when they were selected. I was suspecting it's apostles. Pardon me?
A little bit different reference to also false apostles.
Oh, yes. That's a whole other picture. So let's back up, and we've got the apostles, meaning those sent forth, and we've got Paul now qualified to preach the message of the resurrected Christ, the Savior. This is the hope of Israel. Randy, I've got a point I want to make. Go ahead.
I was just going to read the requirement passage in Acts chapter 2.
Okay.
When they were looking to replace Judas.
Okay.
Peter says in verse 21, Acts chapter 1, therefore it is necessary that of the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning with the baptism of John until the day that he was taken up from us, one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. So they put forth two men, Joseph called Barsabbas, who was also called Justus, and Matthias. And they prayed and said, you, Lord, who know the hearts of all men, show us which one of these two you have chosen to occupy this ministry and apostleship from which Judas turned aside to go to his own place.
Okay.
So that's how Matthias was chosen.
That's right.
But specifically to be a resident witness of the resurrection.
Right. That's right. Now, let's get back to our incident before, our instance before Agrippa, back in Acts 26. Here's the reason, Paul said, that the Lord appeared to him. And this is what I did. This is the message that I preached, a message of repentance, that they might turn to God and that they would do works worthy of repentance. Now, if you drop down into the text, look at verse 24. Paul continued, and as he thus made his defense, Festus with a loud voice saith, Paul, thou art mad. Thy much learning is turning thee mad. But Paul said, verse 25, I am not mad, most excellent Festus, but speak forth words of truth and soberness for the king. Who's he talking about now?
Agrippa.
For the king knoweth of these things, unto whom also I speak freely, for I am persuaded that none of these things is hidden from him, for this hath not been done in a corner. Now, Paul's point, what's his message? The resurrected Christ. You want to tell me that Agrippa, as king over this land of, essentially the land of Palestine, he hasn't heard of what was done in Jerusalem just a short time before? Doesn't know anything about it? Why, sure he does. It's likely that Festus did too. But Paul's point is to Festus, Agrippa knows these things to be true. He knows them. He's heard them. Now look, if you will, at verse 27. And then he turns his attention to King Agrippa. And he said, King Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? Now, just in the asking of that question, Paul is aware of King Agrippa's familiarity with the prophets. Now, he was not a Jew, but he knew what the prophets had said. Now, if you look at verse 27 continuing, he said, I know that thou believest. And Agrippa said unto him, and I want to comment on this verse, reading it now from the American Standard Translation, with but little persuasion thou wouldest make me a Christian. Now let's pause there. We note in the King James translation, perhaps a more familiar expression, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Both are declarative statements, but there are those who believe that rather than to be saying that Paul, you almost got me, you just about got me over the line, that what Agrippa is actually saying in a declarative statement is somewhat of a snide remark. Do you think that with just a little bit of persuading, you can make me a Christian? Now, be that as it may, you can go either way on that, and it doesn't change what Paul is saying to King Agrippa. But the emphasis is placed upon what Paul said in response to Agrippa when he said, whether with little or with much. Lost my place. Paul said, I would to God that whether with little or with much, not thou only, but also all that hear me this day, might become such as I am, except these bonds. Now, as Paul makes his defense before Agrippa, if we take the position, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian, you almost got me, or Paul, do you think that with just a little persuasion, you'll make me a Christian? Either way, we've got the element of persuasion to become a Christian. Now, when Paul said, I would to God that whether with little or with much, not thou only, but also all that hear me this day, what all that hear me might become such as I am. What was Paul? Persuaded. He was persuaded. Now, what swings the pendulum of persuasion? Facts, evidence. That's right. And the evidence that's been presented to Paul is irrefutable. He saw the resurrected Christ.
I was just going to say that he had the type of persuasion very few could have.
True.
He was an eyewitness of the resurrected Christ.
True.
And that's why he was so compelling to listen to. Here, Festus is kind of, Festus says you're out of your mind, kind of like casting judgment upon him. Like, everybody knows that I'm the smartest person in the room, but everybody can see how crazy you are.
Yeah. But that raises an interesting question for consideration. And that question is, do you have to see a miracle in order to know what it confirms to be true? Now granted, he had seen a miracle. He had seen the resurrected Christ. But yet at the same time, we read of others who had not seen that.
We also have several eyewitness accounts in the Scriptures.
This is true. This is true. You know, sometimes I ask the question in Bible classes when you consider Luke chapter, chapter 12, I believe, or is it chapter 16, with the rich man and Lazarus, 16 beginning in verse 18, I believe. We note that both men died, and Lazarus was carried away by the angels into Abraham's bosom, and the text tells us that the rich man died and was buried. And in Hades, he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, and seeing Abraham afar off, raised the question, have Lazarus come over and dip his finger in water? And Abraham told him, can't do that. And then the rich man said, well, send him to my five brethren, lest they come to this awful place. Well, now, what would they have to know about Lazarus if they saw him? That he'd been dead. They'd have to know that. Now, the question I ask often in Bible classes is, would you believe somebody that you knew had been raised from the dead? Would you believe their message? Like the rich man thinks his brethren would? How would you answer that? Well, you'd like to think you would. But what did Abraham tell him about his five brethren? That's right. If they didn't listen to the prophets, they won't listen to Lazarus. Now, you see, the element is the element of persuasion. Facts, evidence. It doesn't necessitate a miracle.
And the Lazarus that we know of that was raised from the dead, they wanted to kill him again.
They wanted to kill him again. Yes, that's true. All right, we'll stop.